Let's continue our deliberations. We're going to talk about the insurance project. Roberta?
Yes, thank you. So we have an agenda paper 4. So the board is considering its response to the concern and the implementation challenges that have been raised since IFRS 17 was issued. This session asks the ESAF members for input on the topics that the board is considering for possible amendments to the requirement in the standard. Any amendments are intended to ease implementation, including reducing implementation cost without causing a significant loss of useful information relative to that which will be provided by the existing requirement in IFRS 17. At its October meeting, the board identified criteria for considering any amendment, which are summarized in slide 4. And at that meeting, the board also considered a preliminary staff analysis of the concern and implementation challenges, in which the staff indicated the 6 topics in slide 3 as areas where possible amendments could be made. So we are now analyzing each topic to demonstrate whether there is a need to amend IFRS 17 and whether amendments could be done in a way that would meet the criteria set by the board. So today, we would really appreciate your suggestions on how we can do that, as set out in the question on slide 5. I would propose to discuss the 6 topics individually. And I wanted to note one point about topic 15, which is about the separate presentation of groups of assets and groups of liabilities. For this topic, the possible changes to IFRS 17 requirement for the presentation on the balance sheet will be discussed by the board next week. So the staff recommendation is to amend IFRS 17 to require a separate presentation of insurance contract asset and insurance contract liability at a portfolio level rather than at group level. So for this topic, we would welcome ESAF member comments on this possible approach. And so I would suggest to start the discussion with this topic. And then we can continue, I think, following the order in slide 3 for scope, acquisition cost, coverage unit, reinsurance, and transition, if it is okay. So I would hand over to you for the discussion about the balance sheet presentation.
Can I just say one thing first? And hopefully I'm saying what you intend and you're not going to thump me later, but the plan is that we want to mainly focus on these 6 areas, but after we've done that, if there's other topics in the list that the board's going to be deliberating, we'd be happy, I guess, to hear comments on those as well.
Yes, okay? Yes, of course. We are still working on also other topics, and so we will start with these 6, but then if you have comments also on the other, we welcome those.
We want to start with the 6.
Yeah. Yes, if possible. Yes.
And in fact, start with number 15. Sorry.
If you agree.
Patricia.
Well, I'd like to start off by saying that EFRAG is not going to offer solutions or directly address the question. We are very grateful to the ISB for picking up on the concerns that we expressed in the letter to you, that you would further consider those. We're monitoring what you're doing very carefully, but at this stage we're in no position to offer any solutions to any of the issues raised.
Thank you. So you appreciate the ISB, which has been doing the best to address concerns and the implementation challenges that have been raised by stakeholders about requirements in IFRS 17. Before we give our observations on the 6 topics indicated in the agenda paper, we would like to ask to how the ISB would address the remaining issues, as you mentioned, other than the 6 issues out of the 25 issues presented in the agenda paper of the October ISB meeting. We believe that the stakeholders need to be fully convinced why the remaining issues, other than 6 out of 25 issues, do not meet the criteria for the amendment. We hope that there will be a process to fully explain why those issues do not meet the criteria for the amendment. Can I, item by item, to comment item by item. Among the six,
Should we respond to the first question?
Let's just cover that first, because I think it's important.
About our plan for discussion. So following the October meeting with the 25 topics, the board has already discussed two of those 25 topics in November. So this leaves the 23. And starting from the meeting next week, we are planning to bring papers for the board to discuss all the other topics, explaining exactly why there is a need or there is not a need for change. So of the 23, 13 will be discussed next week, and the remaining 10 in the future meetings. So starting from January, February. This is the plan.
So that will all be covered again in board papers over the next couple of months.
Okay. Yeah.
Because actually the board has not made any decision on the other topics so far.
Okay, please continue, Sang-Soo. Yeah, the second
15,
question.
Please.
Among the six issues, issue one, especially the loans and the other forms of credit that transfer insurance risks. I think we need to consider both perspectives of non-insurers and insurers. Firstly, in terms of non-insurer perspective, loan and other forms of credit that transfer insurance risk are commonly issued by non-insurance entities such as banks or securities firms. These contracts are included in scope of IFRS 17 because they transfer significant insurance risk despite a relatively small insurance component. If IFRS 17 is applied, however, it may be very burdensome to the non-insurance business. Accordingly, we think that it would be appropriate to allow an entity a choice between applying IFRS 9 and IFRS 17 to those kinds of contracts. And in another perspective from insurers, those contracts may be issued by an insurer. In the case where insurers issue those kinds of contracts, the application of the IFRS 17 may be needed for the purpose of a comparison with the accounting treatments of other products issued by the insurers. In fact, IFRS 17 requires that insurers apply IFRS 17 to an investment contract with discretionary participating features for comparison between the accounting outcomes of products issued by insurers, even though the contract does not transfer a significant insurance risk. So we think that it would be more appropriate to apply, to allow an entity a choice between applying IFRS 9 and IFRS 17 to those kinds of contracts, but to require applying it consistently. And issue number three, acquisition cash flows for renewals outside the contract boundary. We agree with the staff's preliminary thought regarding the amendment of the requirements of acquisition cash flows for renewals outside the contract boundary. We think that it would be appropriate to amend IFRS 17 to require or allow an entity to allocate insurance acquisition cash flows directly attributable to a contract and to expected renewals of that contract. And issue point seven, contractual service margin. We think that the ISB views the insurance contracts which apply the general model do not provide investment-related services. However, we do not agree with the view that the contracts with indirect participation features which apply the general model do not provide any investment-related services. The contracts with the indirect participation features are structured in a manner that the company and the policyholder share a part of the issuer's asset return according to the contractual terms. We believe that the insurance contracts that are not direct participating contracts provide investment-related services, and they should be reflected in the coverage units applied for the contractual service margin allocation of those contracts. However, some insurers think that if the ISP starts to address the amendment of coverage units under the general model, it would be necessary for the ISP to review IFRS 17 comprehensively, since coverage units have an effect on the overall IFRS 17. For example, on CSM release, recognition of revenue expenses, principles of accounting models, and so on. Therefore, they recommend that the ISP explore the amendment to IFRS 17 that could be made without unduly disrupting implementation processes that are already underway. And another issue, number 12, reinsurance contracts held. Since insurance contracts and reinsurance contracts held are separate contracts, it is appropriate to separately represent the rights and obligations arising from insurance contracts and reinsurance contracts held. We agree with the amendments to avoid accounting mismatches and to solve inconsistency of IFRS 17 requirements for reinsurance contracts held at initial recognition and at the subsequent reporting date. And issue 15, finally, separate presentation of groups of assets and groups of liabilities. IFRS 17 requires that a combination of rights and obligations arising from a set of insurance contracts be presented as an insurance contract asset or an insurance contract liability in the statement of a financial position, and prohibits the offsetting of a set of insurance contracts. And this is consistent with the conceptual framework and IAS 1. I think such separate presentation would be helpful for information users to predict future cash flows from the contracts. But many stakeholders, however, object to these requirements, claiming that they cause operational difficulties and excessive system development, and demand that they are presented at a higher level, such as the portfolio level, considering current insurance contract accounting practices or company operating units. So we agree that the amendments will facilitate the application of IFRS 17 and reduce costs. But I'm concerned with the loss of useful information by offsetting assets and liabilities. So finally, issue number 24, modified retrospective approach. Since some insurers are concerned that the modified retrospective approach does not provide sufficient modification, such as for the calculation of the discount rate, we think that it is necessary to amend IFRS 17 to clarify or simplify the requirements of the modified retrospective approach. However, other insurers think that if the ISP starts to address the amendment to the requirements of the modified retrospective approach, it would take too much time. Therefore, they recommend that the ISP explore the amendment to IFRS 17 that could be made without unduly disrupting implementation processes that are already underway. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, does this question react at all, or
just absorbing? Yeah.
Okay, Patrick.
So I suspect we are taking the global approach rather than the
Yeah, I think so, rather than...
I can change, but that's my understanding.
Our efforts to channel the discussion has been fruitless, so you can...
I follow on the path.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, I think we welcome, since last discussions that took place at ASAF, we welcome the fact that there is a discussion at ISB level on a number of topics. We think it is good because we support the issuance of a genuine standard since IFRS 4, as we all know, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not extending too much or qualify too much IFRS 4, which was rather grandfathering local gaps than creating a true global environment. So yes, it's going in very much in the right direction, but the standard being having to be built to last. I think the final dialogue that you have creating, the final debate that you have, and the review of the ultimate improvements that can be introduced on the standard, all of this is most welcome. So they're very supportive of the current phase in the development of that standard. In doing so, we certainly suggest to fully take on board the contributions coming from the field test that has been carried out in the European Union and the topics deserving further consideration as identified by EFRAG and other jurisdictions, which you are doing. So that's good. One remark on the criteria for evaluating changes. We suggest not to put too much emphasis on the disruption of implementation, because I think that the ultimate objective is to get the best possible standard. In other words, substance is the primary objective. Might disrupt some of the implementation phases already underway, but I don't think it would be that much. On the 25 topics that you have identified, we, as ANC, we are trying to work in order to contribute in a constructive manner. So, I can tell you where we are and react at the same time on the issues that you have raised for this discussion. We have submitted, and it's on our website, already three contributions to you. And unlike EFRAG, because we are in a different position, we have tried to go as far as proposing amendments to the standard, because the devil is in the details, and as long as you do not write precisely, you're bound to make mistakes. So we tried, it's tentative. We have the feeling that on two topics, which are topic 3 and topic 15, we are in a position where there is a possible convergence between the views we express and the views that are under consideration by the board, acquisition cash flows and balance sheet presentation. On balance sheet presentation, I have one remark, because that was the initial question. So if I can elaborate a little further, I'm not sure that the key concern is to go at portfolio level. I think that the key concern is to retain the level of information that was available until now, which I think is very relevant, which is the level of premium that have been issued that are not paid yet, because that's an information which is produced by the system, which is very relevant, which will be used, by the way. It's not changing the valuation approach of the overall asset or liability. It's a presentation issue. It's true also for outstanding claims. So I think there are merits to go back to disaggregate what was bundled at group level, to disaggregate, to go back without changing the underlying valuation approach on assets and liabilities which are well understood by the market. This is very useful information for us, more than the fact to do it at group level or to do it at portfolio level. I think, frankly, this is what we think. So on acquisition cash flows and balance sheet presentation, I don't think we need to elaborate more. On the third contribution that we have sent, and which is on our website, on level of aggregation, this is a point which has been mentioned by FRAG. This is also a point which we consider as very important. Frankly, we consider that maybe ISB should be considering again. My personal perception, I would say it in very broad terms, is that the way you aggregate contracts is reflecting the way insurance business is responding to a legal and social environment. And therefore, by changing the level of aggregation, by reducing it, probably below what is required under Solvency II, for instance, you are bringing an element of risk of disrupting what is being done currently, at least on the EU market. For other markets, I'm not sure. I have the feeling that it is a bit the same, but I cannot have the same level of certainty. So I think that ISB should have a look at that. On the other topics, the other three topics that have been mentioned by FRAG as topics for consideration, reinsurance is certainly one. So topic 12 on slide 3. But I would say it's the onerous aspect is important, but I think you should consider as well the prohibition of VFA, because under certain circumstances the difference between reinsurance and co-insurance is very narrow, and in fact we know cases where in fact it's called reinsurance, but it looks like it. In fact, in substance, it's co-insurance. And contract boundaries, because I know there it's a difficult area, but I think it should be reviewed. On transition, we are working at the moment. By the way, we will submit to you a document on reinsurance very soon. We are almost finalized. On transition, yes, there are concerns. So we welcome the fact that you are considering it. And on CSM allocation in the general model, yes, it's a good idea, and we welcome the staff's endeavor to investigate solutions. It is key to properly reflect the performance regarding new developing activities in particular. One topic has not been mentioned, and other topics have not been mentioned by FRAG, but we recognize that topic one in slide three is certainly a real topic, and that something should be done, because I think that attracting those products under the insurance umbrella would be probably counterproductive, and it's counterintuitive, so it's counterproductive. We also think that a final review of the interaction between IFRS 17 and IFRS 9 is needed, but that will be, if I may, at the end of the process, because we need to recap, because that was a concern that we had when we analyzed IFRS 9 back in 2015. Also constructive obligations for VFA. There is also a concern on mutual entities, but we will elaborate further and tell you. Last and not least, we note in a positive way the one-year postponement and subscribe to the principle of postponement. However, we think that what we hear from a number of stakeholders, not all, is that 1 year is a little short, and in principle, we would be suggesting to finalize the question of the timing once the substance has been addressed. In other words, yes, 1 year is fine, but is it the final timing solution? Let's have a look at the substance. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Alberto?
Very quick. Congratulate the ISB for having tackled, had the intention to tackle all the points raised by the industry. Some are in a better started, others will be, if I understood correctly. EFRAG, we don't have a solution, but we would suggest to take on board all the suggestions which others may put forward. We will do perhaps in the future. And we have seen the documents which are on the website of the French colleagues, and we believe that they are really worth considering from your part.
Linda?
Thank you. So I want to caveat my comments in terms of how we did some very limited outreach. We convened a conference call with our Canadian Transition Resource Group. And just to remind everybody, the group consists of preparers, both from an accounting and actuarial side, as well as auditors from an accounting and actuarial side, users, etc. So it's typically how we form any advisory group. The boundaries, or the rules for this, I shouldn't use the word boundaries, sorry. The rules for what we said, please review the criteria that the ISB has set, and within the confines of that criteria, which of these, what do you have to say about each of these, okay? And of the six, there were five that the group felt could be addressed with the emphasis on not disrupting the implementation. So I'll go through those first. So on acquisition cash flows, what the group had to say was they thought the standard could be amended based on your criteria. They think that by amending it, you would get relevant information to the users. Specifically, they focused on the notion that when you do an acquisition and you want to hang on to that business, you necessarily think about not just the initial period, but you also think about renewal periods because you're making a strategic decision. And therefore, you would get a counterintuitive result if you don't go beyond, if you don't consider the renewal periods, because it's almost like it's a bad thing that you've got projected renewal periods. And so they identified it more as a business issue, but also a reporting issue. And they thought that, you know, that you could go beyond into the renewal periods in this case without damaging things. However, one of the things I asked them about was if you do that and you set up some assets, then everywhere else in literature, if you set up an asset or you defer something, okay, you have to do an impairment test. And I asked them if they were willing to actually consider an impairment test, which they seemed to say, yes, they would be willing to do that. And they alluded to IFRS 15. So that was the view on that particular one. With regard to reinsurance, they also said yes. And it became a very interesting discussion around the way the industry thinks about what reinsurance really is versus perhaps the notion that if you think about an insurance contract, there's the direct insurer issuing a contract and then there's the reinsurer issuing a contract. But in essence, the direct insurer sort of nets that all together in terms of the risk. And it's very clear that that's intuitive in terms of the way they make decisions and the way they make pricing decisions, including assessing whether or not that direct contract may or may not be onerous because they know that they've got this reinsurance treaty. And so for the, so in our mind, that original contract may be onerous because of the direct insurance piece, and they're saying, well, no, it's not really onerous because I've got reinsurance. So that came out a lot in this particular discussion. So they think that if you don't make this change, basically what's going to happen is you're going to get more contracts that actually do appear to be onerous. You're going to take that loss up front, and then you're going to have a gain coming down the path, and that's not great financial reporting. And so on that basis, we did talk a little bit about there's two proposed approach. One is called the P&L approach, which I'm sure you're familiar with. The other is called the balance sheet approach. And in essence, the group was more supportive of the P&L approach, although they acknowledged that that one's really only effective from a reporting perspective when the onerous contract situation arises. So that's reinsurance. CSM amortization. They think you could modify that as well. I mean, the industry's preferred approach would be to, again, I'm going to use the word people hate, but to bifurcate the components of the contract between the investment product and the insurance coverage. But they say that IFRS 17 doesn't allow you to do that, so therefore they'd rather see the CSM amortized over the delivery of service, but including both components of service. And the example they gave is if you've got an annuity contract that has a small insurance component, you're standing behind that annuity contract for 10 years, and at the very end, in essence, you've delivered the insurance component, whether or not you paid out on that insurance, or you then have to go into a new annuity contract. And so they don't really want to wait until the end of that period to recognize all of the CSM. They think you should be allocating it over the entire period on the basis of the combined services. So that's CSM amortization. On the balance sheet presentation issue on the netting, that's an interesting conversation because no one could really articulate whether there would be a cost savings if you went from the group to the portfolio level. And I don't know if they're far enough along in their system implementations to be able to really assert it. There was some, yeah, that makes sense. We think it would help. And so there was an intuitive appeal to taking it just naturally to a higher level of aggregation. But my personal view in questioning them was not sure if they could really quantify the cost savings. They said, yeah, it would definitely save a lot of costs, but I don't think they're far enough along, and that's a Linda Mizan point of view. Although I did do insurance accounting for 10 years, just so everybody knows. So there is support for taking it to a higher level. We did get into a conversation around, was there going to be any, you know, information that the users would have gotten at the lower level that would be useful to them versus at the higher level? The industry seems to be pretty focused that they don't use that information anyway. But my comment was, well, they don't have it now, so how do we know they don't use it? So that ended up in a very kind of circular discussion, as I'm sure you can imagine. On the retrospective, the modification, there's a lot of discomfort, in particular around paragraph C8. The notion is it's already hard in our jurisdiction to demonstrate that you can't get information because in the mindset of our regulators and the auditors, just get it and get on with it. So the notion that you have to, for each element, justify that you can't get the information seemed to be a bit onerous. And at some point, the discussion went through, what's the weight of evidence? If you've looked at something and you've already determined that there's one or two or three aspects that you can't get, at some point it becomes pretty apparent. You just don't have the information. So at least look at the wording there in terms of how high a hurdle are you trying to achieve in terms of being able to get into the modified retrospective approach. So with that, let's go back to the scope of IFRS 17. The group pretty much felt, interestingly enough, that within your criteria, that you probably couldn't effectively deal with this issue. The fact is, the fact is that this is an insurance contract standard. So this is where I'll drop back into being an ex-banker. If we're going to use banks as an example, banks issue products where they kind of attach some little insurance component. But then you get into a discussion of whether it's not a substantive insurance component. And I'd be happy to have conversations with you about how often that insurance component actually pays out. So the point was, is that most banks, if they offer that, are sophisticated enough to deal with what they need to deal with, whether it's 9 or 17, to determine whether or not the insurance component is substantive. The group also raised the notion that you would not have comparability for similar products between different types of entities if you just scope this out. And the notion would be is if you try to scope it out, how effective are you going to be in actually just scoping out the tiny piece you want to scope out versus people trying to wiggle into the scope out in different scenarios? So at the end of the day, the group concurred that they didn't think that within the confines of your criteria that they could actually, that you could actually deal with this in a timely basis.
Okay, let's stop it.
Can I ask a question on that one? I'd love to, because it's very complicated, but.
Yep.
So do you not share the concern that there actually are some products which probably banks in particular would think of as being banking products would meet the definition of an insurance contract in 17 because there is something which is significant insurance risk, even though in the context of the instrument overall it may not be a, you know, substantial, trying to use a neutral term, part of the contract,
right,
that would be a problem because today, based on my reading of the words at least, they don't have a choice but to take the whole thing to 17.
Yeah. So, and yes, I actually personally understand that aspect. I also personally think that if you've just given or will, once you've done due process till 2022, that things can be done to resolve some of those issues. So it was a group's view that based on your criteria that this would be difficult for you to deal with without disrupting implementation.
Anthony?
Thank you so much. Well, just starting with the criteria, I generally support it, but there's one element that's missing there is to what extent would a change that actually improves the faithful representation, actually improves the accounting, to what extent would you be willing to trade off some additional disruption by that? It seems to me a filter that says if it's below this level, you know, we're not doing it, but there's no sense of any trade-off of what about if you really are going to improve the faithful representation. And I think just a couple of the items that Linda mentioned, there could be an argument that you wouldn't just be limiting the loss of information the first half of the criteria, you'd be improving the information. So I would just say that the one should expect or be willing to accept more disruption if it's going to improve the final product. Thinking about solutions and also thinking about how you then go ahead and apply the criteria, just as Alberto said, you know, I think other people have already put solutions out there. I wouldn't just look to those as being perhaps that's the answer, but also in terms of applying your criteria, if someone is able to come forward with a potential solution, you know, I don't think that can be ignored when you are trying to assess your criteria against your criteria. Someone has made an effort towards getting the solution. So, so I would just say consider all of that and consider improvements too. Looking at the six issues brought to death, I do think, looking at number one, I do think there are products which would be better accounted for as a financial instrument. I do think things like equity release mortgages, for example, student loans, for example, where the insured risk really arises from the debt product. I think that's what's specific about it that makes it odd to allow the assurance tail wag the dog. And I don't think we can try and look at those. And whilst the paper talked about separating components, or historically at least, some preparers have separated the components, and we shouldn't just discount that one, do we?
The definition there, so the insurance product is the tail and the bank product is the dog. Everybody would understand.
In this case.
Yeah.
But the And so one shouldn't discount that of what was done previously, but I think within the context of your criteria, it'd be very much more difficult to go down a componentization route than the one I think you probably are looking at, which is scope it out completely, fair value through P&L most likely, because it's going to fail the SPPI test if you take it as a whole into that. I can see there's some simplicity about that to consider. Three, I would agree with Linda. I think actually, whilst less prudent, it probably is more fairly representative in many cases to release the acquisition costs, including renewal periods. I can certainly imagine situations where it is, you know, thinking about medical insurance, where the turnover of customers is very low. The average renewal period is more like a 10 to 15 years. So they're willing to incur costs in year one and it become and it appear to be an onerous contract. Fifth, is that providing economically useful information to the market to say that there is been a bad commercial decision, either you've entered an onerous contract when you have? I do wonder a little bit about the scale of it, because it seems to me that the where that kind of affects the model is going to be most significant, i.e. where there's a long renewal period or regular renewals, then chances are it's probably a more stable market and it probably averages out anyway. But I think that's probably a little bit unfair. If you're looking for a general model, it does seem to me that the spread across renewal period is more fairly representative. Seven, coverage units in the general model. Clearly, one of the examples you picked up is annuities, and for the UK, that is a major sort of product group that there's some concerns about it. But it isn't self-evident what the service being provided is, quite clearly. But I don't think. So I do think we've got to try and examine a little bit more the economics of this. I'd start with a very simple version. So we say you pay a lump sum today, and from 15 years in the future till you die, it pays you money. What's the economic impact of a death in that period? In that, it's clear that from year 15 onwards, it reduces the insurer's cash outflows. They stop paying you because you're dead. What's the impact of you dying between now and 15? It's the same. It reduces the overall net cash outflows of the insurer. So, you know, it seems to me to the current solution that self-evidently says the insurance period is only when the insurer is paying out, I'm not convinced that is clearly the right answer. Because throughout the whole life of this product, even during the accumulation phase, it's the same insured event, death, or lack of longevity, or whatever, and it's the same impact. The insurer, it reduces the insurer's total net cash outflows. So why do we end up saying the service is only when the insurer actually happens to be paying out? So that's why I say, whilst it isn't self-evident what the service is that's being provided in the accumulation period is, to me it's also not self-evident that there is a service, it's only at the end. Now, is it during that accumulation period some form of kind of stand ready obligation? Is it some form of guarantee they're giving that they will be there to provide this product in the future? I don't know. You know, it's not self-evident, but I think the economics need to be looked at again to double check. Because it isn't clear to me, insurance is only in that final period, and yet definitely not in the accumulation period. On the reinsurance contracts held, you know, there are solutions around, and I'm sure you've seen them and to consider them. And so I won't go through actually sort of promoting one or the other, but I do think, again, this is one where perhaps a more faithfully representative answer could arise from thinking again about reinsurance. Now, clearly it is a starting principle in accounting, a fundamental principle almost, that we don't net off. We treat assets, we treat liabilities separately, and never the twain shall meet. But we also know there are times when we are willing to relax that. Now, the obvious example is hedge accounting. I'm not trying to promote hedge accounting solution here, but what I'm saying is when we look at hedge accounting, we don't say it has to be an absolute one-to-one match for us to reflect in the accounting the risk mitigation that's going on. And I think with to date with reinsurance, it's felt a little bit like unless you could absolutely, because reinsurance often does not become a perfect match to the insurance, we shouldn't go there. We should keep the asset and liability separate. That's sometimes the way I've sensed the discussion. But actually, what the way those in the business operate is to say we are mitigating risk. Yeah, yeah. We do consider these things together, and our business model does incorporate that. But trying to find that middle ground of where you are reflecting the effective reinsurance, if I can put it that way, I don't think is necessarily straightforward, and particularly not when you move into looking at VFA and boundary as well. Yeah. I think it's incumbent to look at that because there is risk mitigation going on. To what extent can we fairly represent that risk mitigation is the way I try and look at it. 15, it seems to me it is a cost benefit trade off. But I would look carefully on what benefit users do think they will get from the information. And to Patrick's point, is this the best breakdown of assets and liabilities, or would a different one, which is also easier to find, be more useful? I don't know, but I think that's ultimately all this is about. I think this one, it's about the benefit of this breakdown compared to the cost of acquiring it. Finally, on the transition to the modified retrospective approach. I think the standard should encourage preparers to get as near to the best answer as possible, and the best answer is full retrospective. So we bring modified in as an opportunity to get near that, but in a way that when the full retrospective isn't achievable. Unfortunately, what I hear repeatedly is actually that's almost as difficult a hurdle as getting a full retrospective, and you're falling all the way to fair value. I can't assess that. I'm not there doing it, but that's and the one area that really comes up as being important is the focus on the historic cash flows, and that's the piece which is actually is most impracticable to reconstruct after the fact, and is the thing that is that is forcing people away from the modified. So somewhere of a more principled approach, let's say, than a very prescriptive approach to try and represent as near as possible a retrospective approach is the way to do it, is what to look for. I don't pretend that will be easy, but I think that should be the objective, trying to get as many preparers as close as possible to a retrospective, because if the answer is most will fall to a fair value, that's definitely a suboptimal solution.
Thank you. Yukio?
Yes. Our understanding is that the tentative decision made at the November ISB board meeting to defer the mandatory effective date of IFRS 17 for 1 year applies regardless of whether any modification made to IFRS 17. We think the tentative decision is pragmatic solution that respond to the preparer's concern that the originally effective date is difficult to meet. So if the ISB were to make any modification to IFRS 17, we'd like to suggest that the ISB explicitly ask for comments in the exposure draft whether constraint to think further deferral of the effective date is necessary. The ASBJ ASBJ
could do that explicitly. We'll get the answer.
Okay. ASBJ staff is currently exploring how to address topic 7, the coverage unit in the general model. We'd like to share our idea with the ISB staff once that exercise is completed.
Thank you.
Okay. You?
Okay. Thank you. Generally, we support IFRS 17, and the project team in China did a lot of work this year to make a revision to the current Chinese corresponding accounting standards. We translated the IFRS 17 into Chinese, and it was published last week. And we also did some field tests with the insurance companies and have dialogues with the regulators. Generally, the regulator also in support of the IFRS 17. And the project team is working on drafting the exposure draft of the Chinese account, Chinese insurance accounting standards, and it's expected to be published soon. And to be specific on the six topics, we consult some stakeholders before the meeting, and I would like to share some of the preliminary comments on the six topics. On topic one, the scope IFRS 17, we support this amendment. At the same time, we suggest that if the board intends to make this amendment, it's necessary to clarify the definition of such contracts and further define which standards is applicable to such contract. If so, it may be necessary to make amendment to the scope of some other corresponding standards. And on topic two, topic three, the acquisition cash flows for renewals outside the contract boundary. We have some concerns about this amendment and suggest the board to be careful to reconsider whether to make this amendment. Firstly, it's not common in practice, and the Chinese insurance regulator don't encourage this kind of activity. Secondly, we don't think that the deferral is appropriate. Thirdly, we have some concern about how to distinguish the acquisition cost of the original insurance contract and the renewal contract. It's difficult to implement it in practice. On topic seven, we think it needs to consider both the investment services and insurance services under the general model. On topic 12, we think that if ISB intends to make this amendment, we suggest using a method similar to the paragraph B115 to B118 in IFRS 17. On topic 15, we generally agree with the view of the staff in the agenda paper that of offsetting the assets and a liability between different groups indicates that they don't meet the requirement of the conceptual framework. However, due to the cost-benefit principle, we suggest that maybe some more flexibility should be allowed. That is, the level of the detail of the grouping could be relaxed. So the system transformation cost of the companies could be reduced as much as possible. And for the last topic, we suggest a more simplified method because unlike other standards, there is no consistent requirement for the insurance contract before the issuance of IFRS 17. So, the situation varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Therefore, we suggest the SB should give more flexibility in the retrospective approach. For example, according to the paragraph B, 137 of the IFRS 17, companies that prepare interim reports need to use retrospective according to the frequency of the interim report. We don't think it's necessary, and suggest to allow allow using the retrospective approach on a yearly basis. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Chris.
So this is always interesting. So what I'm going to do, because obviously AOSSG is a collection of different countries and views, you've already heard some of the individual countries, so I won't repeat those. So the two extra ones I'll just throw into the mix are Hong Kong and Australia. So Hong Kong has three topics that it's particularly thinking needs to be addressed. So that's 7, the CSM for the general model, 12, the reinsurance contracts, and 24, which is the modified retrospective approach. So in terms of solutions, with the CSM, they have suggested that you keep both the VFA and the GMM models, but reconsider whether the pattern of the CSM allocation under the GMM model should be more, for the investment components piece, should be more consistent with the general revenue recognition principles. So they're trying to get back to a more principle-based approach rather than a rule-based solution. In terms of the reinsurance contracts, again, they're after a principles-based approach which would avoid the P&L mismatch situations. And in terms of the modified retrospective approach, the suggestion there is to improve the understandability of the modified approach and also just simplify the requirements in respect of the historical data. So they think that would be similar to Andrew's comments, that would help get closest to the full retrospective approach, but make it a little bit more reasonable and supportable to get to that point. So from the Australian perspective, there's really two key issues. So the first one is the reinsurance approach, and we've already given a suggested solution to that. Now, Linda mentioned there was a P&L approach and a balance sheet approach, so I'm not quite sure which one's which, so I might just outline, because I can see both of them could be a P&L and balance sheet approach. From the Australian perspective, there's sort of two aspects to the reinsurance piece which is seen as being important. So the first one is the onerous contracts and getting a matching of the revenue from the reinsurance contract matching where there's an onerous contract at or after the inception of the contract. So there's a recognition that if it's the onerous contract's being recognised prior to the inception of the reinsurance contract, that shouldn't be, there shouldn't be a matching in that scenario. But once you've actually got to the contract point and that's when you recognise your onerous thing, then yes, you should be matching the revenue at that point. The second piece is around, I guess, the TRG's decision that for reinsurance contracts you should also be reflecting the circumstances where there might be new insurance contracts that will be covered by the reinsurance but they haven't yet been issued. And so that one obviously created some issues, and so that's why I was a bit confused about P&L and balance sheet, because our suggested solution in that case would be you defer recognising the CSM of the reinsurance piece until you actually got the insurance contract in place. So that's kind of a bit more like a balance sheet approach, whereas the first one is match off the loss of the revenue into the P&L at the same time, which is more what I'd see as a P&L approach. So it's a bit of a mix of both. So we are aware that Europe has come up with an alternative solution. And so whilst the Australian view is we just want to get a solution, the preference isn't really the European approach, because we think that will be more complicated to keep track of the actual components, and that the practical aspects of that might turn out to be more complicated than the solution that we've promoted. So that's the reinsurance piece. In terms of the aggregation issue, which is the other big issue from an Australian perspective, I'm not sure what Australia would actually think of Patrick's solution of going back down to the premium piece, but certainly either the portfolio or the entity approach is considered an acceptable solution to dealing with that aggregation issue. But we totally agree with Anthony's comments that it's a cost-benefit trade-off here.
When you're talking aggregation, there is the separate presentation.
15. Yep. Yes. Sorry, 15. No. 15. Yep. But I would say overall, the region is very supportive of the approach that you're actually taking to deal with these issues, and so commend you on coming up with a very good approach.
Patricia has objections against the
I just wanted to clarify that when you refer to the European approach, presumably you mean the CFO Forum solution?
Yes.
That's all right, because I don't want any misconception that EFRAG at the moment has any position about any approach.
Or anything.
At this time, Patrick. Okay. Not immediately, but at this stage.
Declare neutrality for the minute.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any more comments? I think this is very useful for the staff again.
Yes, I think. Thank you very much for being.
Do you feel any need to make any comments, Andrea or Berta?
Just really to say that, as you highlighted in the discussion, we have received some input on many of the topics, and we're considering all the input we've received as we're developing the paper. So you should see that coming through in the papers as you get there.
Okay, thank you very much. I suppose that brings us to the end.